everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2019, and you're listening to episode 124, Conscience, Justice, Morality, and the College Admissions Scandal. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Paul M. Gould, who teaches philosophy and apologetics at Oklahoma Baptist University and is also the founder and president of the Two Tasks Institute. He is the author or editor of 10 books, including his most recent book, Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World. Paul has written an online exclusive feature article, and it is called Conscience, Justice, Morality, and the College Admissions Scandal, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. Paul, it's good to have you on.
Thanks, Melanie. It's great to be here with you.
Well, in this article, you talk about the fact that we shouldn't be surprised that cheating is, you know, basically rampant, given the current view of a lot of people that happiness is, you know, the number one goal that they have as the satisfaction of all their desires. And why is this? And why does our view of happiness have anything to do with morality and the moral life? And of course, you know, the college admissions scandal, unless you're living under a rock in the United States, everyone in the past month or so has heard about how celebrities and extremely wealthy parents who are, you know, multimillionaires could easily afford all kinds of services for their kids, but instead chose to pay folks to make a way easy into colleges, even sometimes, well, for the majority of the kids didn't even know about it. So why were parents even, you know, motivated to do this? Most people think that's so wrong. What justified it? And, you know, just talk a little bit about what you mean about this view of happiness.
Yeah, that's a great question. I've always been struck with, there was this Enlightenment philosopher named Blaise Pascal, and he said this really startling thing. He said that all people, all men desire to be happy. And then he says, even that those who hang themselves desire to be happy. And I think his point was that, you know, all of us want this thing called happiness, and we'll do whatever we can to get there. And so it makes sense if today the dominant view on what it means to be happy is this idea. It's kind of this combination of, we're happy when we have sensual pleasure and when we basically find success. And so if you could summarize that, happiness amounts to today this unfettered satisfaction of desire. And of course, if that's what happiness is, well, then we can do anything, you know, any means to that end is appropriate. And so if many people today think that, you know, we're going to be happy if we have the American dream and, you know, if we have stuff. And of course, we're told that to get that, you need to have a good college education and to get a good job and a good college education, you need to do well in school, in high school. And so it makes sense that, you know, cheating would be rampant, given that's the sort of dominant view of what happiness is.
Your title of your book has the words disenchanted world in it. And you mentioned that we live in this disenchanted world, you know, where the social order has been separated from the sacred order. Can you explain a little bit more about that? First of all, please define social order and then what you mean by that versus sacred order and the separation of it. How has it been severed? And what does that mean? And why does it matter in terms of morality?
Yeah. So, okay. The social order would just be the arena of humans and the interactions, you know, that we engage in daily to flourish as humans. And traditionally, in fact, all the way until this modern, all the way until the age that we find ourselves in today, traditionally, there's been this idea that how we ought to relate as humans is determined is determined by what is called the sacred order. So there's God exists, and there's a way that we ought to flourish and the way that we ought to relate in virtue of who God is and what God says is, you know, the vision of human flourishing. And what's interesting, I read this book by Philip Reeve, who was a Jewish sociologist, and he talks about how we live in an unprecedented age, the only age where the sacred has been severed from the social and the natural order. In other words, today, anything goes. You know, there's no sacred order. There's no way things ought to be. And because of that, the word I use in my book, Cultural Apologetics, is that we live in a disenchanted world. And the idea there is that, you know, there's nothing beyond the mundane. Everything is ordinary. There's nothing supernatural. There's nothing transcendent. And so we're just kind of making our way as humans in this vast sea of nothingness, as Nietzsche would put it, you know, figuring out for ourselves how we ought to behave and how the kinds of people that we ought to be.
In the article, you share an analogy by the author C.S. Lewis. And for some of our listeners who might not know who that is, he's probably best known for a series of children's books called The Chronicles of Narnia. And he has this analogy of a fleet of ships, and it's, you know, you're using us to help us understand the moral life. Can you explain what that analogy is and how it helps us understand the moral life? And also, why is morality today viewed only along a social dimension? And what kind of dimensions should it be viewed along?
Yeah. So C.S. Lewis wrote, actually, it was a series of radio broadcasts during the war that became eventually the book that we now know as Mere Christianity. And in that book, he has a chapter called The Cardinal Virtues. And in there, he uses this analogy of this fleet of ships. And he basically says, in order to have a successful fleet of ships, you have to have three components. And the first component is the individual component, that each ship needs to be individually seaworthy. You know, all of its planks need to be well oiled and everything working together. The second component is what he calls the social component. And that's the idea that the ships need to be rightly related with respect to each other, that they need to be close enough so that they can help each other in times of need, but not too close so that they don't bump into each other and things like that. The third component to a successful fleet of ships is that they need to be rightly related toward their end or their destination, the place where they're headed. And Lewis uses that analogy to help us understand the nature of the moral life. So like that fleet of ships, the moral life has three components. It has the individual component, that we would be rightly related to ourselves. That's the idea of character. The social component, that we would be rightly related to each other. And then, of course, the third component is the end, or we might use the word teleology, that we're rightly related toward our end. And what's happened, because we live in this disenchanted age, this idea that there's a purpose or a teleology or an end to humans has been widely rejected. So that third component has been removed. And then the idea that character and virtues are important to the moral life has also been removed, because there's this idea that, you know, there is no human nature. There is no essence that it's such that humans flourish in light of their essence. And so the individual component has been removed. And so morality today is a very thin conception. It's the social only. And the problem with that, though, is that we've reduced the social dimension to maybe one or two moral principles. You know, basically, you can do anything you want as long as you don't hurt anybody else. And that's pretty much a very, very thin conception of morality. But I think Lewis helps us to understand a more robust view of the moral life to include all three aspects there.
And how would you answer that question of, well, as long as I'm not hurting anyone else? For example, in your article, you talk about this college student. It was an NPR interview where this college student is not using, so she doesn't feel like she's plagiarizing any essay, because she's actually paying somebody else to write an essay. It's an original essay. She doesn't have time. She's too busy. And she sees it as kind of a gray area. And she would probably, it doesn't say that in the interview, but, you know, she'd probably say, well, I'm not hurting anyone else. It's just something that I need to do for me. So what is it? What's wrong with it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that even Lewis's three-part analogy helps us understand that number one, she is hurting herself, because she's cultivating a habit that will form her character in a vicious way, in a way where she thinks that cheating and cutting corners and things like that are appropriate ways to behave. So it is shaping her character, and it's going to hurt her in that way, because it's shaping her in a deformed way where she won't ultimately flourish. But it's hurting others too, because in cheating, in plagiarizing, you know, those who are worthy, who are trying to, you know, gain college admission or whatever the goal is on their own efforts, they're going to be they're going to be set aside because maybe, you know, this essay has helped her get ahead. And so it actually is a form of injustice and hurting others. And then ultimately, it's not going to help us live life well. And so it might actually prohibit us from achieving our true end. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, so it actually, our actions are never this sort of microcosm onto themselves, but they have these unintended and consequences that ripple off from, you know, everything that we do. And so, yeah, so it does matter.
Well, given that it does matter, even if an individual thinks, well, what's the big deal? You know, a lot of people today would say, you know, our culture is morally sick and, you know, that we don't have a vision of what it means to be human and we don't see a place for virtue and even vice in the moral life. So what is virtue? What is a virtue? Why should we care? Why should anyone care? And especially as Christians, why do we need to care about our character?
Good. Okay. So think of it this way. On the Christian story, reality is infused with purpose. I mean, so we come into the world as humans and we take up our place in this ongoing story. And so our job then is to find our place in God's divine drama. And of course, the world we live in, the words that I like to use, it's actually enchanted. It's mysterious. It's purposeful. It's sacred. But notice then, importantly, when we add teleology or purpose back into the picture, we begin to understand our lives as a kind of quest or a kind of journey. So we're headed somewhere. And so where are we headed? Well, we're headed toward our true end or our highest good, that which will make us happy. And of course, I'll say a little bit more about this in a moment, but our highest good is communion with God through union with Christ. And so there's this question, well, then how does virtue and how does vice fit into that picture? And I think the answer is this, that virtues help us to live life well and vices prohibit us from a life well lived. And notice, of course, we live in this world that is at once lovingly sustained and cared for by God. That's true. But it's also full of real danger. And we're vulnerable and we're fragile beings. And so when I think of the Greek word for virtue, it's arete. It just means excellence. So here's what a virtue is. So a moral and intellectual virtues can be understood as those stable qualities of character that enable us to do three things. Number one, they enable the evil of life to be overcome. Number two, the task of the good life to be accomplished. And number three, the journey to our end to be complete. So that's a little bit on why I think virtue is so important. And of course, we neglect this. We're not going to live life well in the way that God intended.
Can you unpack for us what some specific virtues are? I was having this conversation with a sophomore in high school who is an international student who lives with us. And we're just kind of talking about leadership and virtues. And literally, I mean, he was just racking his brain. I could see him trying to think and he couldn't come up with more than one or two. He just had no context for what that would be. And I don't know if that's unique to him. I think a lot of younger generation kids, particularly the Gen Z kids that have grown up just online constantly. I don't know if you said, okay, give me 10 virtues, what those even would be. So can you list them for us and why those are significant?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. And I think you're exactly right. This language of virtues is largely absent from the moral landscape and the moral discussion. And that's, in a sense, that's a real impoverishment, because historically virtues are central to the good life. And so here's something that's been helpful. There's four what are called the classic virtues, and then we're going to add to those four classic virtues what are called the theological virtues to get the seven basic virtues that actually I think give us a clear map or picture of what it means to be human. So the four cardinal virtues and cardinal just means hinge virtues, the virtues from which all the other virtues sort of hang, are these: wisdom, which is the chief intellectual virtue. And wisdom is basically understanding the sacred order of things and then living our lives according to its grain. So that's wisdom. And then justice, temperance, and courage. So those are the four classic virtues. These are the virtues that the Greeks were most interested in. Sometimes they're called the acquired virtues because they're things that we develop through habit. And then, of course, the medieval theologians added the three theological virtues to the four classical virtues. And we find these in Paul, actually in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 13, where he talks about faith, hope, and love. And these are actually virtues as well. So faith is the, this ability, the stable trait of character to have ventured trust in a worthy object, namely God. And then hope, which is this beautiful virtue, is, this idea that one day all of our deep longings will be satisfied. And I love, hope. If faith sets us on the path toward God, well, hope is that which sustains us on the path to God. And then, of course, love is the virtue that subsumes all the virtues, our love for God and then man and ourselves is this chief theological virtue. And so if you take those seven virtues and then begin to unpack them a little, it actually gives us a vision of what it means to be human and how we flourish. So that's where I would start in terms of the specific virtues and a little bit about what each of those are.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Paul M. Gould, who has written an online exclusive feature article for the journal, and it's called Conscience, Justice, Morality, and the College Admissions Scandal, and it's available to read for free online at our website, equip.org. We'd also like you to subscribe to the journal, and when you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, you join the team of print subscribers whose paid subscriptions help to provide the resources to minister to people around the world who come to our website seeking to be equipped. And these resources include, of course, our free online exclusive articles. A subscription is $33.50. And to subscribe, please visit our website, equip.org. In addition, we'd like to encourage you to support this podcast by partnering with us. And you'll find a link on the landing page of this episode at equip.org where you can receive Paul's new book, Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World, for your gift of any amount. And that will be our thank you gift to you. So it helps to keep this podcast free. We were just talking a little bit about, Paul was explaining to us the specific kinds of virtues, and he talked about flourishing. So, we start out this podcast saying that people's chief goal these days is to happiness. So what can you describe for us, what does happiness actually consist in, and what does it mean? You've mentioned a few times human flourishing. What does it mean to flourish as humans? And can you specifically explain how the seven virtues that you just mentioned a few moments ago are connected to human flourishing?
Yeah. Okay, great. I love, I'm always reminded of C.S. Lewis. I really enjoy C.S. Lewis, but in his book, The Problem of Pain, he says this in a chapter on divine goodness. He says, God gives the happiness there is, not the happiness there isn't. And then he says, we basically have three choices. We can either be God, which of course none of us are, or we can be like God and enjoy him in creaturely response, or we can eternally starve. And so really it boils down to these two options. We can be like God and enjoy him in creaturely response, or we can eternally starve. So the idea of human flourishing is that we would flourish in light of our nature. And to put a little more meat on that, I think ultimately the thing that is man's highest good, the thing that we are created for, is relationship with God. It's sometimes called union with God, but it's just the idea that we're created to know God. And so so flourishing amounts to union with God, number one, harmony with others, right? Number two, right relationship to ourself. Number three, that's the character part, as we live out our God-given end. That's the teleology, or the end part. So I think that fourfold concept of flourishing helps us understand, how we're on this journey, and it requires that we become a certain kind of person to successfully achieve it. And of course, the beauty, by the way, of actually not just the theological virtues, but all the virtues. Sometimes the theological virtues are called the infused virtues, whereas the four cardinal virtues are called the acquired virtues. They're infused, meaning that they're gifts from God. I actually think on the Christian story, all of the virtues, we join with God, we partnership with God to grow and to become more like him. So we use this theological word of sanctification. So happiness ultimately, though, amounts to a relationship, that we're created as by a relational God to be in relationship with the creator of the universe. And that's what genuine happiness is. And of course, the virtues and all those other things help us on our journey toward our true end, which is happiness.
I want to ask specifically for Christians. So You know, how can we walk the like proverbial plank of the human conscious and build a bridge from our culture and issues that we face in our culture to Jesus in the gospel? And how would you describe the universal human longing for goodness?
Yeah, so this, in my book, Cultural Apologetics, one of the really helpful insights was actually as I was reading a philosopher named Peter Kraft. And he talks about how God has given us these three prophets of the soul, which are the universal longings for goodness, truth, and beauty. And then he's given us guides along the way on our journey toward these objects of our longing. So God has given us reason as a guide on our quest toward truth. And then God has given us a conscience on our quest toward goodness. And God has given us the imagination to help us on our quest toward beauty. And of course, as you put your theology cap on and you ask, well, what is the source of goodness, truth, and beauty? All of those find their source in Jesus Christ. And so these innate human longings that we have for goodness, truth, and beauty set us on a journey that ultimately terminates in Jesus. And so how can we, as Christians, build a bridge from, and this is part of the central thesis of my book, how do we build a bridge from our Athens, the place we find ourselves in, to Jesus and the gospel? Well, one bridge is this plank of conscience. And I parse out the longing for goodness, this thing that we all long for, into three sub-longings. And they actually correspond a little bit to that the Lewis analogy about the fleet of ships. First, we all long for wholeness, you know, that we just want to be whole. We want our willings and our thinkings and our emotions to be pointing in the same direction. Secondly, though, we long for justice, right? We have the sense that something has gone wrong and we want to right side up the world. So we long for justice. And then third, we long for significance, right? We long for a story that matters. And so I think all three of those sub-longings are part of this longing for goodness. And so as we awaken those longings within others, we're actually setting them on that journey that culminates, that culminates or ends in Christ. So that's a little bit about how we can use this sort of plank of conscience by living whole lives, by being and seeking justice, and then by living for another, you know, a story that's greater than ourselves.
How would a Christian communicate, especially, you know, I was mentioning earlier Gen Z. So I was talking to a non-Christian student, and she's a senior in high school, and I would say I don't think she would think that she has a universal longing for goodness. I mean, her highest priority is like, how can I be rich someday? And in light of the college admission scandal, you know, if anyone's read some of these articles, it's like one of the celebrities, her daughter, her biggest focus was she feels so frustrated that in her parents doing this, her parents helped her lose all these great endorsements that she has, because her thing in life is she just wants to party and be a YouTube influencer or an Instagram influencer. And when so many kids spend so much time on social media looking to these kids their same age, more of that horizontal thing where they're just looking for peer, like what the peers are, as many, you know, past generations have, but I think it's more heightened now. They'd be like, you know, goodness, what's that even about? Like, if I could be an Instagram influencer and get all this free stuff, that would be the good life.
Yeah, I think that one of the interesting things about disenchantment is that it suppresses our deep longings of the heart. So think of it this way. Think of the set of our longings, our desires that we have as humans, as an inverted triangle. So at the top, you've got our surface desires. And then as you go down, you find your deeper desires. And then, of course, right at the bottom there, you have the human heart's deepest desire. Now, I think that deepest desire, the thing right at the bottom, would be our longing for God. So I love how Augustine said it in the Confessions. He says, you know, that you've created us and our hearts are restless and until they find rest in you. But if you go just above that deepest longing, I think you do find there those longings for goodness, truth, beauty, love, justice, and so on. These deep desire of the heart that are present, but often muted, because a lot of the time, and I think you did a great example sharing about the, I forget her name, but I know the person you're talking about who, you know, is losing all those endorsements. She's all the way up at the surface longings, thinking that those things will bring us happiness, of course. But really, the key question that I think we can ask of people in our culture, Gen Zers or really anybody, is just press this question: what is it that you want? And in asking that question, You know, and not just the surface longings, you know, let's drill deep. Because I think as you explore and plumb that longing, even that longing for endorsements, which leads to fame, which leads to happiness, right? As we're, what is the longing behind that longing? What's the deeper longing? Well, I think it's a life of significance. Well, that's all the way down at the base. And so sometimes it's reawakening the longing. Other times, it's simply drawing the connections and explaining how that longing for fame is really rooted in a longing for a life that matters. And that longing is something that can only be satisfied in the gospel story, because that's the only story that's alive and true and that actually understands us. And so I think part of our job as cultural apologists is to learn to ask key questions like that, to diagnose and to sort of plumb that triangle of longings, to push people deeper. And as we awaken those, and I love, I'll say one last thing. I love how Lewis puts it in his afterword to another book called A Pilgrim's Regress. He says that we have this kind of dialectic of desires that's taking place where we tether to something that we think will satisfy, and then it doesn't satisfy, so we untether. And then we tether it to something else, and then it doesn't satisfy, so we untether and retether. And he says, if we faithfully follow what he calls that dialectic of desire, if we faithfully follow it, it will lead us like a kind of ontological argument to the true object of our longing, which is God. And so I think part of our job as cultural apologists is to reawaken that, and then to help others faithfully follow that longing to its true source. So yeah, that's a great question. That's a little bit about what I would say and do there.
I've mentioned a couple of times your book on cultural apologetics, and I want to encourage everyone to support this podcast by making a donation of any amount to get Paul's book. And I want you to explain, you just mentioned that phrase, cultural apologetics, what that is for our listeners, and specifically, what's the problem that you're trying to address in this book?
Okay, good. Yeah. So the problem I'm trying to address is basically this idea that, you know, today Christianity suffers from an image problem. We might put it that way. The reality is that for many of us that, you know, the relevancy of Jesus is disconnected from life. And so we're largely anti-intellectual as a church and as a culture. And so in that mindset, the result is the Christian voice is muted. And so the gospel doesn't get a fair hearing. But it's not just that. We live in a culture where the collective conscience of the culture is muted, as the Christian conscience is muted as well. You know, daily we read of Christian leaders who disqualify themselves for moral issues, or you know, non-Christians are often just as fragmented as our non-believing neighbors. And so as a result, the church isn't able to play that prophetic role that we're historically called to do, to be salt and light in the world. And so the Christian conscience has been muted in culture. But more than that, Christians largely view the world the same way everyone else does. We use words like it's mundane, or it's ordinary, or it's everyday. That's the word I use, is disenchanted. But that's actually not the way the world is, right? The world is deeply beautiful and mysterious. And to use the proper word, it's sacred, it's gift. And so the Christian imagination has become muted in culture. And so as a result, here's the problem. Christianity today is no longer viewed as reasonable or desirable, or both. And so that's the problem that I'm addressing. And so the way that I've defined cultural apologetics is basically the work of reestablishing the Christian voice, the Christian conscience, and the Christian imagination so that Christianity will be viewed as true and satisfying. So that's the project that I'm concerned with in that book.
You just mentioned that, you know, our culture is influencing, you know, Christians' views of morality. And I would ask you, well, how is the collective conscience of our culture doing that? And why do you think that it is? I mean, why is it doing such that, you know, even Christians themselves find their own views of morality to be muted, or not to see the importance of pursuing intellectual pursuits or some of these things that we've talked about, you know, considering any of these virtues?
Yeah. I think let's go to the why first. The why, I think, just to start with us and what we need to own, is largely the anti-intellectualism that is rampant in the church today. And so we no longer have a theology of culture, a theology of human persons, a theology of, you know, sexual ethics or race or whatever it is, that's robust, that's grounded in scripture, that's winsome, that's intellectually humble, and so on. And so what happens in a largely anti-intellectual environment, which of course is true of the culture in general, but of course true of the church as well, unfortunately, what happens is we're guided more by our feelings and our emotions than we are by right reason and the deliverances of scripture and theology. And so as a result, there's a real pressure socially to conform to the image of the world, basically, instead of being transformed by the renewing of our minds, as Paul would put it in Romans 12, 2. And so I think that's part of the problem, is that we're just, we're not being mindful as Christians. We're not living whole lives as Christians. And so we're basically becoming like the culture around us. So that would be the why. And that's how we're influenced as well, because there's real attractive voices out there that are guided by feelings, and we want to be like them because we watch the same movies and you know, social media streams and stories on Snapchat and so on. And we want to be like them, and we want to be liked. And so sometimes we cease to think critically, or at least robustly critically, about things, because we want to associate with a certain view or a certain person. And as a result, we often become like them in terms of our own views and morality as well.
Is there any advice? Sometimes I write from the editors in the journal from the perspective of a, you know, minivan driving mom, because that's what I am. And when you think about kids or teens or whatever, like one of the new apps that's popular is something called TikTok. And it's these like kind of really crazy, weird videos that are 15 seconds. In that kind of environment where kids will just watch a long string of these 15-second videos just on all kinds of random stuff with cool, you know, special effects and so forth, how can parents encourage imagination and intellectualism? Because it seems like the girl that I talked about earlier that was interviewed by NPR, she just doesn't really care about any of that. It's like it has no bearing on her daily life. It's just going to be too much work to read a book to even write something about it. How should Christians, when our kids are, you know, entertained by a lot of like videos and video games and things like that, how can we help them see the importance of intellectual pursuits and even thinking?
Yeah, this is a great question. In some ways, part of the burden of the book is just this idea that it's not business as usual in the church today. That's, you know, we live in this age of image that is driven by image, and we're trying to flourish as Christians in the midst of it. And so I think I would just say a few things. Number one, we've got to realize that technology is not neutral, and that it shapes us and it informs our characters, often in ways that are detrimental to human flourishing in the gospel, because they're shaping our habits, and the things that we're watching are seeping into our bones and forming a view that's often antithetical to a robust view of human flourishing as we find in the gospel and the way of Jesus. And so we've got to be counterculture, and we've got to remember that the gospel is subversive to the dominant narratives of our day. The second thing, I was speaking a couple weeks ago at a conference in beautiful South Texas, and we went on a hike. They were all high school students, and we went on a hike in the beautiful hill country there. And one of the leaders was talking to a student, you know, and, you know, hey, how was your hike? And she's like, oh, it was amazing. You know, great. Why was it so good? And she said, oh, because I got 3 bars at the top of the hill. And we've got to teach them to see reality and delight in reality the way that Jesus does. And that's going to require intentionality on our part. It's going to require, intentionally placing scripture and the beautiful narrative of the gospel story in our own lives as front and center. And then here's the prayer. The prayer is that we would pray as parents that self-denial would become natural in our lives. It's kind of a scary prayer, but it's the way of Jesus. And in doing that, we're modeling to our kids another way. In fact, the only way in which we'll find true life, you know, by following another and living for another. So yeah, it's got to maybe start with us as parents, and then just realizing nothing is neutral, and then helping them, what I say in the book, to return to reality in this sense, that we learn to see and delight in the world the way that Jesus does. And I offer a whole host of ideas of how we might do that in the book. But that's a great question.
You know, one of the buzzwords, I think in the church too, not just in a culture, but especially for, you know, Gen Z, millennials, is this idea of authenticity. Like you have to be your authentic self, or we're looking for people who are truly authentic. And I don't know if they mean like someone who just is an open book where they kind of just share every detail about their lives. But is there something wrong with this modern view of being, you know, your authentic self to the world. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, so Charles Taylor, who's an important Catholic philosopher, has written a lot about this so-called quest of authenticity that we find. And it's driven by, if you want to drill down a little bit, it's driven by the rampant individualism that is one of the chief values of this disenchanted age. But it's the idea, actually, it was really well encapsulated by Steve Jobs. He gave a speech in 2005, actually, it was the commencement address at Stanford, where he basically said this. He said, your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life, which sounds fine. But then he says, don't be trapped by dogma. Don't let the noise of other opinions drown out your own inner voice, heart, and intuitions. They somehow already know what you truly want to be. And so here's this idea, and I think that Steve Jobs encapsulated it now, that, you know, to be courageous today, to be authentic is to follow your heart, to follow your inner voice, you know, and be true to it. So here's the thing. On this way of being authentic, there is a way of being human, and it's my way. You know, I'm called to live my life and not anyone else's, and to be true to myself. And sometimes I call this the Disney conception of courage and authenticity. But here's the problem. There's actually two problems. Now, I think they do get something right, that we are called to be true to ourselves in this sense, that we are to love ourselves. Yes. But the first problem is that in seeking to be true to ourselves, one elevates that love of self as the highest form of love. Now, of course, we're to love ourselves, but we're to do that in its proper order. And in other words, we have to contextualize self-love within all the other so-called, what actually philosophers would call, the offices of love. Or as Jesus put it, that we love God first, and then we love our neighbor as ourselves second. And so that's the first problem, is it elevates self-love in a way that's ultimately destructive to ourselves and to others. The second problem, though, with this sort of modern conception of courage and being authentic, you know, as being true to our inner voice, is that it's problematically subjective, right? There's no objective vision then of what the good life amounts to. And there's no nature that we ought to, you know, aspire to. And so as a result, as Lewis would put it, we're going to end up eternally starving. And so what's interesting, though, the actual virtues, since we've talked a little bit about those seven virtues, the virtue of courage is an interesting one. It's composed of two things. It's the ability to attack evil and then to endure evil. And if that's what courage is, notice the paradigm courageous person then becomes the martyr. And I actually think that's instructive for us as Christians, because like I said earlier, what does Jesus call us to as Christians? Well, he calls us to self-denial and to live our lives for another. And so on the Christian story, all of us can be courageous, not just the superhero. You know, we're all so fascinated by Marvel right now as Endgame has just come out. And we want to be like those courageous heroes, but that's actually unattainable. But all of us can live our life for another in self-denial. And that's, of course, the way of Jesus. And so that helps us understand, I think, as we put ourselves within the strain of the gospel story and the actual virtue of courage, then we do find our authentic self, because there we become most human. And we do that, of course, by not listening to our own inner voice, but by listening to a voice of another. And that's so important, I think, in our day and age, if we're going to really flourish and be actually authentic to who God wants us to be.
I think that Steve Jobs quote is always very interesting. I've used it before in the past when I've spoken at various different women's retreats and things like that. And one thing I've used it for is to show the power of a worldview, because before I quote him, I ask everyone, you know, in this room, do you have a smartphone or know anybody with a smartphone? Will you raise your hand? It's everybody. Even if someone has a dumb phone, they know someone. And I just, you know, the power of him doing that and pursuing his worldview compared to what you're saying, just the beauty of what true truth is in the gospel and in Christianity. And so, you know, finally, how do Christians join with God and other believers to really, you know, reach a culture and awaken them with this idea of the, you know, not on the surface things that people are looking at, but just to go deeper to that deep longing that you talked about of goodness that truly resides in every human heart.
Yeah. So I love, just to go back to Augustine again, he was the one, remember, who said that our hearts are restless until they find rest in you. That was in his book, The Confessions, which is this wonderful, it's actually the very first spiritual autobiography of the Western world, where he kind of shares his journey to Christ. But in there, in book three, he says this, and this is really interesting. He says of God, he says, "You are the beauty of all beautiful things." And then he says, "You are the good of all good things." And I would just add, the truth in which all true things point. And so how can we join with God and others to awaken longings? I mean, I guess it has to begin with us. It has to begin with us as Christians being convinced that there is a story that's alive and that understands us. And that story is the gospel story. And that in that story, we find the true object of our longing, which is Jesus Christ. So it begins with us, I think, entering in and taking up our place in the only story that's true and satisfying. You know, as C.S. Lewis put it, it's true myth. It's story, but it's a true story. Because in there, we find the only joy that there actually is, and so on. So it begins there. And then I guess the second thing then is, as we locate our lives in this story, that we would, and as we begin to see the world and delight in the world the way that Jesus does, that we would learn to invite others to join with us and to see the world the way Jesus does and to delight in it and to take up their place in it. And we do that by living whole lives. We do that by being agents of justice. We do that by living for another. We do that by rejecting anti-intellectualism. We do that by imagining ourselves, this is the idea of rebaptizing that imagination, by imagining ourselves within a story, namely the gospel story that is alive and satisfying, and so on. So it's going to require all of us to be whole people and to join together, because we live in a time that is unprecedented, as the sociologists tell us. And so it's not business as usual, where we really need to embrace the gospel as our only hope and Jesus, you know, as the only thing that actually satisfies. So how's that?
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Paul. So Paul, it's May. Which of these vegetables that are in season this month do you prefer, asparagus or zucchini?
Oh my. Well, definitely not asparagus, so we'll go zucchini.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
I am an introvert.
Call or text?
Text.
How many siblings do you have, if you have any?
Yeah, I do. I have an older brother and a younger sister, so two siblings.
And do you prefer washing dishes or doing laundry?
I prefer washing dishes for some reason. I guess the same reason I prefer mowing the lawn, because you actually see progress, at least for a minute, until it gets dirty again. So, dishes.
Well, thanks, Paul, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
You're welcome. It's great to talk with you, Melanie. Thank you.
Today's guest is Paul M. Gould, who has written an online exclusive feature article for the journal, and it's called Conscience, Justice, Morality, and the College Admissions Scandal. And it's available to read for free online at our website, equip.org. We'd also like to invite you to subscribe to the journal. When you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, you're joining the team of print subscribers whose paid subscriptions help provide the resources to minister to people worldwide who come to our website and are equipped by our resources, including our free online exclusive articles. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe, please visit our website, equip.org. In addition, we want to encourage you to support this podcast and to help keep it free by partnering with us. You'll find a link on the landing page of this episode at our website, equip.org, and you can receive Paul's new book, which we talked about on today's podcast, and it's called Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World, as our gift to you for your donation in any amount to help keep this podcast free. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraph, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast.